Okay, welcome back to our next installment of the Great Jewish Books course. Tonight's class is sponsored by Betty and Sam Stein, Eva and Alex Lipnick, and Kathy and Shalom Diamond, in recognition of the miraculous ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the chesed he shows all of us on a constant, never-ceasing basis. Thank you very much for the sponsorship. I have to apologize, there was a wire crossed, and despite the fact that we have a sponsorship this week, there is no nosh in the back. It'll happen next week. So the learning will still take place in your merit tonight, and thank you for your sponsorship, and we'll have the food. We'll have to hold off on the bracha. Speaking of which, next week there will not be a regular class in the Great Jewish Books course. We'll be hosting the mayor of Sderot, who will be speaking here during this time slot, so I invite you all to participate in that, and then we will pick up again the following Monday. I think it will be a special Purim class. We'll pay attention to all the schedule and get everything straight. Okay, tonight's class, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, often known as the Or Yisrael, which is the Sefer that was written about him. We'll see, he didn't actually write that particular Sefer. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter has had an unbelievable impact on the Jewish world. And tonight's class is officially Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the Musar Movement. So let us begin. Let me start with a story. We'll start with a story that's many, many stories are said about Rabbi Yisrael, and I will say, as we say every time we tell a story, as Rabbi Beryl Wine always likes to say, can't verify the veracity of every story that's told, but as we say, I feel like we say this every week, they don't tell the same stories. We could change the characters, but they don't say the same stories about Richard Nixon as they do about the Chafetz Chaim. So the stories we'll see about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter are also very consistent in the nature of their story. But let's start with this particular story. There were two Jews in town, and they see Rabbi Yisrael walking by. And one Jew says to the other Jew, "Did you hear the story about Rabbi Yisrael?" The other Jew says, "No, what happened?" And the first Jew says, "Well, the local Shochet, the guy who does the Shechita, came to Rabbi Yisrael and says, 'I quit. I'm not going to be the Shochet anymore.'" Rabbi Yisrael says, "Why not?" He says, "Rabbi, it's too hard. There's too much to do. There are too many halachos that I could do something wrong, and I can mess up the Shechita. I could do this with the knife. There are blemishes if I don't shecht correctly. The responsibility is too great, and I can't have it on my head that there'll be Jews in town eating tray food because of me. I can't handle it." So Rabbi Yisrael says, "All right, well, what do you want to do?" See, he says, "I think I'm going to become a melamed instead. I'm going to become a Rebbe in a yeshiva." So Rabbi Yisrael said to him, "A shochet, there are halachas in Shulchan Aruch that teach you exactly how to do it, and we can check whether or not it was done correctly or not correctly. For that, you're afraid that you might make a mistake and someone's going to eat treif. But for the neshama of a Jewish child, where we don't have a Shulchan Aruch to make sure that you're teaching correctly, that you're raising this child to be, that you're not afraid of messing up." So the other Jew says, "That's not the story. That's not the way it went. You have the story wrong." He said, "The Shochet came and said, 'Rebbe, I don't want to be a Shochet anymore.' And when Rabbi Yisrael asked him, 'So what do you want to do?' he said, 'I'm going into business.' And to that, Rabbi Yisrael said to him, 'Shechita, we have a Shulchan Aruch, we have halachas, we can check to make sure they're doing it right. In business, you know how many halachas there are in business? That you don't steal, that you don't cheat, that you don't overcharge, that your weights are correct. You're not afraid of that?' That's how the story went." That's the story. We'll start with that story about Rabbi Yisrael's life. What's the message of this story, with both versions? What's the message of this story? Think about this, it's an important story. What's the Shochet's concern? In what kind of halacha? In ritual law. I'm so concerned I might make a mistake. And in both versions, Rabbi Yisrael says to him, and in interpersonal law, in your concern about cheating a person a few pennies, if your scales aren't right, about the soul of the Jewish child, you're so scrupulous about Shechita, are you not worried about these other matters? That is the theme that we're going to see. This opening story is the mission of Rabbi Yisrael about a people, a Jewish people, scrupulous on Shechita, and his quest to inspire that same level of care and concern when it comes to the soul of the Jewish person, when it comes to their interpersonal relationship, to inspire that amongst his people as well. Let's start from the beginning of our notes. What is Mussar? We're talking about the Mussar movement. What is Mussar? What does it mean when we talk about studying Mussar, learning Mussar, a concept of a Mussar movement? So the word actually appears quite a number of times in Tanakh. I think it's over 40 times we find the actual word Mussar. The very first time the word Mussar appears in the Torah is in Sefer Devarim, all the way at the very end, in Perek Yud Aleph. V'yedatim hayom, Moshe says to the Jewish people, V'yedatim hayom, ki lo es b'neichem asher. It's not to your children that Hashem is speaking, or that I am speaking right now, says Moshe. Not to your children who don't know Vasher lo ra'u es musar Hashem Elokeichem, who don't know, this would be translated as the chastisement of Hashem your God, his greatness, his outstretched arms, but to you. And the word musar here being used as a form of to chastise, to rebuke. Or in Sefer Mishlei, we find the word Mussar many times in the very beginning, lakachat Mussar haskel, to take or to accept wise discipline. Or Shema b'ni Mussar avicha, hear my child, the Mussar of your father, the discipline of your father, the rebuke, the guidance. And in that context, the word Mussar is someone giving direction or guidance, rebuke, discipline, to make sure that there's a path that you're supposed to be on. And this is to make sure that indeed you stay and maintain on that path. That would be the most original usage of that form of the word Mussar. And then as it developed over time, and the way that it was used by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the experience of acquiring a fear of heaven, what we call Yira Shamayim, a fear of judgment, a constant trembling before the prospect of heavenly scrutiny. That a Jew walks around and he knows, through the study of Mussar, this idea of rebuke, the idea of to be chastised, discipline, to learn, the experience of learning Yira Shamayim, fear of heaven. That our actions matter, that our actions are watched, that our actions are judged, and that we tremble before this idea that there's going to be a reckoning. Now, if you have that fear, if you have that understanding, that requires, in order to get there, a constant process of introspection and awareness. You can't just walk around, you have to have this idea of self-awareness, to think, to be aware of growth, of sensitivity to the needs of others, character development, and an understanding of what true goodness and selflessness is. You need to study that if you want to then walk around with a sense that everything matters because you need to do the right thing. So Mussar is going to be this is just a broad definition to begin our discussion tonight, a broad definition of taking a Jew to a level of awareness of Yira Shamayim, of the fear of heaven, the fear of judgment, the fear of being watched. Now, this is not a new idea. The Mishnah in Perkei Avos says a person should always watch, be aware of three things: that there's an eye that watches everything that he does, and an ear that hears everything that he says, and a hand that writes everything that he. That there's an old teaching. The Mishnah in Perkei Avos teaches it, but the idea of studying Mussar is making ourselves aware of that, of becoming more sensitive, character development, introspection, all of those things. Now, there's an important point to mention here as we talk about this idea of a Mussar movement. All successful movements within the world of Torah Judaism cannot, by definition, be introducing something new. Why not? It doesn't work that way, right? We were given a Torah, we were given the law, we were given. So if it's something new, it would raise an eyebrow and say, where was this before? What do you mean you're introducing something new? So when we have successful movements within Torah Judaism, in effect what we see, now when we look at it, is highlighting something which was there and was either neglected or not given primary importance, and raising that level of importance. So for example, what we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks, the idea of Hasidus. The Hasidic movement didn't introduce the idea of joy to Jewish life. That wasn't a new thing. We have a pasuk in Tehillim, Ivdu et Hashem v'simcha. Everybody knows that. It's that they took, I'm just using this as an example, they didn't introduce the idea of taking tefillah seriously. If you learn the Gemara is filled with statements that a Jew needs to take his davening seriously. What Chassidus did is highlighted certain things which were not focused on, which the masses of Jews at that time who were not intellectually privileged to certain aspects of learning, and gave them something that they could do too. And so they took ideas and highlighted it. In our modern day time, Zionism, religious Zionism, didn't create the idea that Israel is important in Jewish life. That didn't start with Zionism. It actually starts with Avraham Avinu, when Hashem promises him the land of Israel to you and your children. That's where the love of the land began, the relationship with the Jewish people. It's just Zionism highlighted that and made it more significant than it had been. And I'm giving a very broad oversimplification of a very complicated idea. But it's not new, but this new movement, as opposed to, let's say, the reform or conservative movements, which were to either introduce or change something new. But Hasidus and Zionism were just highlighted. So what the Musar movement is doing was taking the idea of Musar, of self-reflection, character development, which was not new in the 1800s. It had existed for a long time prior, and made it a highlight, focused on it, and said, this is where we need to be focused right here, right now, in the world of Jewish history that we find ourselves. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is going to be the founder of this movement, this idea called the Musar movement. Let's share a little bit of the historical context to go over some of the things that we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks to see where this fit into the time that we're in. Rabbi Yisrael himself is born in the 1800s, 1809. He dies in the late 1870s. So in the time period, the 19th century, during this time period. What was life like for Jews in Eastern Europe, where Rabbi Yisrael was, Russia, Lithuania? What was life like for Jews during the 1800s? It was a misery, an absolute misery. And as much as historically people like to look back at the shtetl of Eastern Europe and glorify it as if it was this magnificent place, and if only we could go back to the shtetl, as Rabbi Berowine likes to point out all the time, such a person who says that has no idea what the reality of life in the shtetl was like, which was poverty everywhere, high levels of unemployment, infant mortality was about 40%. 40%. It was a given in life that you were going to have children who were not going to survive. Women dying in childbirth was certainly common. Besides for the natural disease, disaster, and poverty, you had pogroms, you had state-sponsored persecutions against the Jews, where you can live, what kind of jobs you can have. It was literally, literally miserable. As far as that goes, literacy and Torah scholarship was reserved pretty much for the elite. And if you were not in the elite, either from wealth or you weren't bright to be an Eloi, a particularly bright child, it was not open. It wasn't like yeshivas today where everybody goes to school and everybody went to yeshiva. It simply was not like that. And on top of all of that, what probably made it absolutely unbearable was the Cantonist Decrees of 1827. Which was through Russia, which was a great chunk of Eastern Europe. And just a brief description of this, which was really just the nail in the coffin of Jewish life, which is important for our understanding of the context that we're discussing. So the Tsar in Russia had already decreed before 1827, they would set up these what were called Cantonist schools, in which they would basically conscript children, not just Jewish children, amongst the provinces who had to go into the army. And in 1827, they made a decree specifically for the Jews that they were no longer accepting bribes to buy yourself. It was a tax. You could buy yourself out. And in 1827, that was the end of that. And they required conscription from communities. They had to give their children for a 25-year service in the Russian army, which in effect meant you were not going to survive, and if you did survive, you were not going to be Jewish in any recognizable shape by the time you would come home, because you were taken anywhere between the ages of 9 and to 15, and by the time you came back, there was simply no way. The rule was that for every 1,000 members of your community, you needed 4 children to be conscripted into the army every year. Now, just to get a sense of what that is, how many members in our shul do we have?
Every year.
We're about 550 families, so we're about 1,000, 1,500, whatever the number may be. Every single year, 5 children from the shul would be plucked off and sent off and never seen again. Every year. Which 5?
Every year is a lot.
Yeah. So there's a certain reality. I'm not saying this is judgmental, just a certain reality. So who went? Well, there were certain exceptions that the Russian government gave if you were in certain guilds. Clergy had an exception. And if you were very wealthy, you would generally buy yourself out of it. But each community, the Russians, the Tsar, made the community in charge of filling the quotas. And if you heard of the choppers, they would literally pick kids off on their way home from school because quotas needed it to be filled. They would kidnap children in the still of night from their beds, Jews. And the rabbis were generally in charge of making sure the quotas were filled. And they were in an absolutely impossible situation of figuring out, how do you do this every year? Another 5 kids. How do you manage? So who went? So the poor, the orphans, the downtrodden, the nebuchs, they were the ones who were sent. Kids would mutilate themselves to get out of it. It makes you cry, literally, to imagine the scenario of what was taking place, and it was a disaster. And the reality is, again, I'm not saying this, I can't even imagine living in an era like that. But the rabbis and the leaders of the community, whenever you have a terrible situation like that, so whenever people have complaints, who did the complaints land on? If there was bribery, if there was corruption, which of course there was in a system like this. So there was a great, besides for this being the final nail in the coffin of how miserable life was, but it was also a terrible time for the relationship between the leadership, between the rabbis and the people, because of this misery. Literally, it's an unfathomable a time in Jewish history. And so it was a communal disaster. It was a personal disaster for families that lost children. And it was a spiritual disaster. In this context, we have 2 major movements which become immensely popular. One within Torah Judaism and one without. Within Torah Judaism is Hasidus. Hasidus, which reinvigorated life and joy and holiness in everything into a miserable life, found fertile ground. Because it gave hope. The Rebbe gave something to hold on to. It gave holiness where otherwise you might not be able to find it. And without getting into another class, we spoke about Hasidus of the last 2 classes. Hasidus in the early days was very complicated. If you remember when we spoke about the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon held that they were heretics. They were so radical in some of the early... Right now, Hasidim, when we look at Hasidim today, modern-day Hasidim, the Vilna Gaon and the opponents of Hasidim were successful in pulling the fringes back to the center so that it fits within Torah Judaism. In the early days, a lot of things that they did were outside of that pale, and there were many, many who were opposed to it because of that. So it was a movement that from traditional Torah Judaism was a threat. Again, the Vilna Gaon did not allow people to marry Hasidim. He held they were so outside of the pale of Torah Judaism. They were heretics. You couldn't marry in. He put a ban on them. So that was a major threat from within the Torah observant world, and until it worked itself out where we have it today, was a tremendous threat that spread like wildfire throughout both Eastern, a little bit less in Western, but throughout Eastern Europe. And then there was a second threat, which was the Haskalah movement, which we haven't really discussed it in the great controversies in Jewish history. The Haskalah movement, or its adherents were called Maskilim, were basically enlightened Jews. The Enlightenment movement, which swept through all of Europe in the late 1700s and 1800s, which was a new way of looking at the world, a rational way of looking at the world. There was a rebellion against the old Christian dogma, and so it impacted the Jews, and it created what were known as maskilim. And maskilim were basically Jews who were irreligious Jews, but they were anti-religious Jews, and they were bent on philosophically reforming Judaism to fit into the modern world in which they lived. Moses Mendelssohn is considered the father of this movement, introduction to arts and to the sciences and to modern dress and to secular culture, a new form of education. And they had, the maskilim, major complaints against traditional Jewish Judaism. They basically said, you're corrupt. They said that you're backwards. They said that you're small-minded shopkeepers. You're uneducated. You'll never get out of the shtetl. And the world has moved on. And the world did. The 1700s and 1800s and the Enlightenment movement and all the Industrial Revolution changed the world. And the Jew was still living in his little shtetl. And the maskilim wanted to go to the universities and take on science and on all of these things. And they said, your world is corrupt and backwards, and it's time to get with the times. And this movement was probably the single greatest threat to traditional Torah Judaism, because as all of these movements go, who was the most likely age demographic who was enticed by this movement? Of course, it was the young, the youth. And they looked at their parents and they said, they're old-fashioned and backwards, and this is the new trend, and this is modern and new and hip. It's the same story every generation, just a difference, you know, the details change. But once you became a maskil, that was the end of your religion. There was no such thing as what we have today. You could be modern and religious. That didn't exist. You either were in the shtetl or you left the shtetl. And these two movements, Hasidim on one side and the Maskilim on the other, tore apart what was one time the core establishment of Torah Judaism. And the threat of losing your child to the Hasidim, which we would say that's not a threat, it was a threat then, or losing your child to the Maskilim, which was for sure a threat, was a tremendous real, and it was a bitter, bitter battle that took place. We, in today's PC Western world, really can't appreciate the nature of this conflict. Because in today's day and age, it's, you know, we live in North America, it's live and let live. Okay, this one's religious, this one's not religious, this one believes like this one believes like that, this one... That's the world we live in, which is its own challenge that we have. In Eastern Europe, this was a battle for the lives, a literal life and death battle that was open, it was overt, and it was vicious. It just was. And there's no way to really sugarcoat that. Let me just give you one story just to illustrate something which it couldn't even be said today, but it was said. One of the leading maskilim died in Vilna. He died in Vilna. And so the Chevra didn't want to deal with him. The Chevra Kedisha didn't want to do a Tahara, didn't want to bury him. Again, it was vicious background stuff. They didn't want to deal with it. They said, he left the fold. He's nothing to do with us. We're not leaving him alone. But the way that things were, they couldn't get him buried without the Chevra Kedisha. It just didn't work. So the Russian government intervened. The Russian government intervened. The Maskilim went to the government because that's what everybody did. Everybody was playing off the government. All the Hasidim were thrown into jail. Their Rebbes and the Mishnah. It was times that we really can't really, but you have to appreciate that it existed. So the Maskilim went to the government, who intervened, and they forced the Chevra Kedisha to bury him. And they forced the Magid of Vilna, who was one of the leading Rabbanim, to be maspid him, to give him a hesped, to eulogize him. Before the government, the Russian government came and said, give him a hesped. Okay, so this is a maskil. He threw away Torah Judaism. He's not from. He's not Shomer Shabbos. He's not Kashrus. He's anti-religious. And now the leading sage of Vilna is called upon by the Russian government to give him a eulogy. This is a true story. Ma'aseh Shehayah. So he gets up and he says, "You'll please forgive me that I'm not really qualified and I don't know how to deliver a eulogy. I've never given a eulogy for a maskil before. Usually, you know, in those days, the hespedim, if you've ever had a chance to read or hear, they knew how to give a hesped. They would bring in divrei Torah and gemaras and talk about the person's virtues and what they accomplished." So he gets him and he says, "You'll excuse me, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to eulogize this person. But with God's help, more maskilim will die, and I'll have more practice, I'll get better. Now, I can't even imagine, can you imagine someone in today, like, you can't even imagine the words. But that's the life that was. The reform movement is also going to exist more in Western. We'll talk about that when we talk about Rav Shimshon Refol Hirsch and the reform movement. So that's the threat to the life that is existent in Lithuania, in Russia, in Western, in Eastern Europe at the time. They're being pulled in all of these various directions. Enter the scene, Rav Yisrael Salanter. Now, we'll talk a little bit of his biography in a moment. I was on the bottom of page one. And he is going to introduce a third response. Not the Hasidim, not the Maskilim, but a non-Hasidus Hasidus. In which his tagline was, I'm not here to reform Judaism. Which is, in effect, what Hasidus was doing. Which was, in effect, what the Maskilim were for sure doing, trying to secularize and modernize, and it's what the Reform movement was very openly trying to do. Rabbi Yisrael says, I'm not going to reform Judaism. I'm only here to reform Jews. And he took a very interesting approach in which he in effect said, the Maskilim are right. They are correct. Every claim, almost every claim, that they are claiming against us is true. We're uneducated. It's corrupt, backwards, we're small-minded. In the eyes of the world around us, they don't look at us as an impressive people. They're right. Their answer is wrong. But their claims are right. And we need to reform the Jew, not Judaism. Judaism is perfect. But the Jew needs to be reformed so that he or she becomes a person that when somebody of the world looks at him, they want to make a bracha on him. They say, wow, what a person. What a human being. What a child of Avram Avinu. And we're not there right now. When they look at us, they don't see that. I don't need to reform Judaism. I need to reform and inspire and revitalize the Jew. And how are we going to do that? And so that was this idea of Mussar. It was going to be the bridge, he wrote, between, you know, this is pre-psychology, this is in the late 1800s, the bridge between theory and practice. And he wrote that in theory, every Jew wants to be a good Jew. Everybody wants to be honest and sincere and sensitive. But a funny thing happened on the way to practical living between this idea that I have. If you ask any Jew, he writes, what do you want on your tombstone? What do you want them to say about you at your funeral? You want them to say that he was a Nebuch, that he was a mean person, that he cheated everybody? No, everybody wants to hear at their funeral after 120, what a nice and kind and impressive. It's a funny thing happens between that dream that we have and actually living in the marketplace. Funny thing happened on the way to the fight you had with the guy in shul about who was sitting here first or who should get which aliyah. There's a gap between what I want to look like and what actually happens. And no one's thinking about that. No one's paying attention to what happened between I look out in my town, said Rabbi Yisrael, and people aren't nice. But if I would stop them and ask them, they don't set out to be like, this is how every parenting seminar starts. Every parenting seminar starts. No one wakes up in the morning with the goal of, I can't wait to yell at my kids all day long to the point that I'm exhausted, they hate me, and I've accomplished nothing. That's no parent's dream. But why does every day end that way? So every parenting seminar says, there's something missing between the goal when I wake up and every single day ending the same way, I yelled at them again, I'm exhausted, they don't like me, I'm frustrated with them. So something needs to change, right? So the seminar, whatever parenting word, so Rabbi Yisrael said, we need that in our Jewish life. Because every day is ending with corruption and a lack of honesty, and the nations of the world don't look at us and say, we want to be like the Jews. They don't say that. Why not? Said Rabbi Yisrael, we're missing something. And what we're missing is the study of Mussar. And Mussar is going to be the gap, the bridge between the life we want and the life we're living to actually be able to do so. It's going to be a discipline, and he's going to put a program together that's going to be able to do so. As he said, it requires work. It doesn't happen naturally. Just going back to my parenting example, it doesn't happen naturally, but with time, with training, with a few new skills, with practice, with slow incremental growth, you could become the person that you want. Said Rabbi Yisrael, nobody wakes up as a brain surgeon. You have to go through training. You have to practice. And we're going to put individual Jews through that regimen. We're going to make you into a brain. We're going to make you into a tzaddik. Not like Hasidus that you're going to attach yourself to the tzaddik. I'm going to make you into a tzaddik. And here's your program to do so. And as we're going to go through momentarily, exactly what and how did he create that program. Now again, the idea of Mussar was not new. He did not create this idea. If you remember one of our earliest books that we studied together, we studied the Chovos HaLevavos, the duties of the heart, the Mesilas Yesharim, the gates of repentance. Mussar's Svarim have been around for 800 years by this point. And the Talmud is filled with such statements. And the Chumash and Tanakh is filled with this idea. He made it into a discipline. And he said, this is our problem as a community. That he looked around and he said, I'm not happy with what I see. How are we going to change this? So his answer was this idea of this Mussar movement. Okay, let's do a little biographical background before we get back to how he was going to create this. Well, let me do one other thing. His most famous, one of his most famous sayings or stories is a story that there are two versions of it. Either he needed one of his shoes fixed, or he was walking home from shul one night, late at night, it's 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and he sees the shoemaker is still working on shoes in his little hut. And he comes in, he stops in Rabbi Yisrael, and he says, can you fix my shoe, or why are you still here, why are you still working? And the shoemaker said, as long as the candle still burns, there's still work to be done. And as the story goes, that became his mantra. As long as the candle burns, there's still work to be done. The candle, ner mitzvah, nishmas adam, ner, I forget exactly, the Chazal describe in Tanakh, the candle, the soul of a person is like a candle burning. As long as the candle burns, there's still work to be done. We're not finished. If there's breath left in our nostrils, if we're awake up the next morning, there's still work to be done. We haven't yet achieved perfection. That means there's still something to be worked on, and we have another day to work on it. If it's still burning, then you know you still have work to be done. And that became the mantra, one of the most famous. The yeshivas, you can say, the candle still burns. It just means, yeah, there's still work to be done. Candle is still burning, there's still work to be done. Rabbi Yisrael, as I mentioned, was born actually Yisrael Lipkin. Salant was the place that he went to yeshiva when he was 12, 13 years old. He was sent to Salant to study there under Rav Zundel of Salant, and he eventually became known as Rabbi Yisrael Salant, Rabbi Yisrael from Salant, even though he was not really born there, nor was his family from there. And then the Lipkin name is actually Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's name of origin. He lived through the 1800s, from 1809 to about 1883. He was born to a rabbinic family and was a well-established Talmudic genius. One of the greatest stories about him, and I'll tell you why I love this particular story in a moment. I'll tell you the story first. At some point in his life, he traveled around giving shiurim, both to spread his idea of Moses. That's what they would do. They would go from town to town, like the Magid, telling stories. He would give shiurim to tell story to spread his word. So in the way that it used to be done, so the person giving the shiur would post a note on the wall in the entrance to the Beis Medrash of all the sources, the Maror Mekomos, of the things that he would quote in the course of his lecture, so that the students in the local yeshiva would prepare them, and then he would deliver his lecture. Now, we'll see at the very there were some opponents to Rabbi Yisrael's new method. Anytime there's anything new, there's always opponents to it. And he had a number of opponents who didn't like what he was doing and trying to create. So there was, and one such stop, he posted the notes and he went away for a couple hours to either prepare, do whatever he was doing. He comes back to deliver the lecture, and on his way in, he sees that the note that he had posted had been removed, and someone put up a totally random list of sources from all over the Talmud. See this page over here, see a Tosus over here, kind of, nothing to do with each other. And as he walks in, he sees the notes, he takes the notes off of the door as he walks in, puts it on his shtender, and delivers a shiur, weaving together all of the sources that had been put up by such a person trying to trip him up. And so without embarrassing the person or calling out that somebody did such a thing...
It's not recording.
It's not, is this going to count?
Just
all right. It's not going to count. What can I say? I don't know how to... I don't have any backup, so...
Just now.
As it goes back on... the memory card as well. Okay.
I have it audio recorded, so there won't be any video. So that the reason why I find that story... It's recording? It's a miracle. Okay. So, again, Rabbi Yisrael is the founder of a Musar movement, and the story touches upon his genius, not just as a pious chassid, but as a scholar, in the sense of weaving together that story, so as not to call out such a person who would do such a thing, and being able to weave such a thing. But that, he was a well-known and established Talmudist, a Talmud Chacham, on his own. When he went to Salant, he went to study under Reb Zundel of Salant, who himself was a student of Reb Chaim of Volozhin. Reb Chaim of Volozhin, if you recall, was a student of the Vilna Gaon. So we have the trail goes from the Vilna Gaon to Reb Chaim of Volozhin, Reb Zundel of Salant, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is a student of his. Reb Zundel introduces Rabbi Yisrael not just to Talmudic genius, but to this idea of, he himself, Reb Zundel, was a very pious and saintly Jew, and he introduces Rabbi Yisrael to the idea of Musar as a study. And Rabbi Yisrael himself didn't even create that idea. He learned that from his Rebbe, Reb Zundel, that there was an idea of self-introspection, of character development, of making a study out of it. And Reb Zundel charged him with living his life according to that ideal. And Rabbi Yisrael then took that and made it into a movement for everybody, not just for him on an individual level. Rabbi Yisrael himself published almost nothing. Literally almost nothing. We have Nigeris HaMusar, a certain letter. I'm assuming it's just not going to work. A letter called the Nigeris HaMusar, and we have a number of articles that he published in a journal called Tenuva. And the main thing that we have is from his student, Reb Yitzchak Blazer, Reb Itzla Mipeterburg, the Peterburg Rebbe, or Rav, who published a biography and about 30 of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's letters. And he published that in a sefer known as Or Yisrael, the Light of Yisrael, Or Yisrael. So people associate the Or Yisrael with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter because that book, Or Yisrael, has two parts to it. It has a brief biography of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and about 30 of his letters that he wrote to various students and family members. But he himself did not that. It was written by his student, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer. Now, his mission, I'm on the middle of page 2, if you're following in the notes. His mission, as I mentioned, the Maskilim, he took a very novel approach. Again, most of the traditional Torah Jewish world ignored everything the Maskilim had to say. The Maskilim were the enemy. They were literally destroying the youth of the Jewish people, taking them away from observance, from Torah study, from anything traditional Jewish. And he basically said, but they're right. As I mentioned earlier, their arguments are correct, and we need to do something about that. We need to create Jews who are so pure and good and representative of the descendants of Avram, as the people, even in today's modern world, will look at the Jew and say, that's what I want to be with. And that's going to require, A, living with passion. It cannot be by rote. Cannot be you're going through the motions. You have to live every day with excitement and with passion. You have to be meticulous in your mitzvah observance, particularly your interpersonal, between Adam l'chavero, between man and fellow man. Don't just be scrupulous with your shechita and trample over your friend while you go to get your kosher meat. You have to be just as scrupulous with your interpersonal relationships. One of the stories, I'll share this right now. He was very particular, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, with his matzah on Pesach, in which he would harvest the wheat himself, and he would grind it, and he would mix it. He was very scrupulous. One year he couldn't be available to do the actual grinding and baking. So he sent his students, but he was very agitated as he was giving them instructions. And the students asked, like, what's the problem, Rebbe? You're afraid that it's going to be 19 minutes, and you're this, that, what are you concerned with? We'll be very particular. So he said, I'm very nervous. The woman who needs the dough where you're going is an almana. She lost her husband. Please be careful not to pressure her while she's kneading the dough, which would be in violation of, the Torah says, an almana, a yasum, an orphan, the widow, the poor, don't oppress them. So he says, I'm afraid that I'm sending you. You might be too nervous about the status of the matzah, and in your zeal to make sure that it doesn't turn into chametz, you're going to pressure her a little too much. So make sure you leave her alone. Give her time and her space while she's kneading the dough. So you have to be just as scrupulous with your ben adam lechaver, with your interpersonal relationships as with your ritual observance. Make sure you say good morning with a smile when you see someone on the streets. Be sensitive. Be careful and considerate with other people, with their money. Minimize your anger and desire. Patience. This was a program that he was going to create. Now, we're used to this idea. He introduced this as a discipline of focus, something that was going to be spoken about regularly. His mantra is a beautiful phrase. Someone else's gashmius is your ruchnius, he would teach his students. Gashmius means physical needs. Someone else's physical needs should be considered like your spiritual needs. I want you to think about that, because that is one of the most central tenets of his system. That when you see your friend, and so your friend, let's take a classic example from those days, was hungry. They were poor. So taking care of their food isn't just taking care of food. It's a mundane task. That is your spiritual growth. That's for you, the one taking care of it. That's spirituality. Taking care of someone else's physical needs is your spiritual growth. Now, he himself embodied all of this. He was unassailable. You couldn't touch him as a whatever he believed, because he himself was so such a living embodiment of these principles. The stories about him are endless. I just wanted to share a number, just because the stories about him really promote what it is that he was trying to teach. One of the most famous stories that are told about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is from Kol Nidre Night, that all of the Jews in town had gathered on the most holy of the night. There would be Yisrael Salanter, Elzman, from all the Muslims. Elzman is getting ready for the Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and El was this very serious time. And so came Yom Kippur, and everybody's in shul, and Rabbi Yisrael's seat is empty. It's not around. So they're waiting to begin Kol Nidre. He's not there. They're waiting, and they start looking for him. They look in his home, he's not there. They look in the base medrash, and the attic. Where's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Kol Nidre night? Eventually, the Gabbai says, we have to start. Start Kol Nidre, they finish Kol Nidre. Then they finish Kol Nidre, a few moments later, as everybody's ready filing out, Rabbi Yisrael shows up. Where was he? So Rabbi Yisrael said, I was on my way to shul, and on my way to shul, I heard a baby crying. in one of the local houses. Baby's crying and crying, nothing. So I knock on the door. Nobody answers. I check the door, and it's open. I look inside, and there's a 6-year-old girl asleep in front of the crib with a bottle by the child, by the 6-year-old, and the baby's crying. And I realized the mother wanted to go to shul. She put the 6-year-old in charge of the baby. The 6-year-old fell asleep, and now the baby's crying. But the mother's in shul. So I went in to comfort, to wake up the girl, to have her give the bottle to the child. And when I woke up the girl, she realized that she was all alone. She was afraid. And she asked me not to leave, so I stayed with her throughout Kol Nidre night, that she shouldn't be by herself while I went to go tell her mother. So I stayed to be with this child, to be with the baby, while her mother was able to daven Kol Nidre. And for me, this child's gashmius, this child's physical needs, that's my ruchnius. That's one of the most famous stories of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter from Kol Nidre night. They tell her that Rabbi Yisrael used to walk around town fixing the shutters on poor people's homes. Why did he fix the shutters? Because he said at night, when the wind blows, the shutters rattle. And when the shutters rattle, it's going to wake people up. So he would go around making sure to fix the shutters, that they should be hammered in appropriately so that no one gets woken up in the middle of the night by the wind rattling the shutters. He used to study at some point in an attic in his earlier years, and he was supported by a brother-in-law. He used to come and bring him a loaf of bread and some milk, whatever he would bring him. So a child came to give him some food that his sister-in-law or somebody provided for him. So one time the child brings the bread, and Rabbi Yisrael says to the child, he says, "I'm going to tell you a secret." He says, "You know that there are certain beggars in town." He said, "Did you know that those beggars don't have any teeth?" So the child laughs, like as if Rabbi Yisrael was telling him some funny type of joke. So he says, "You know that, right?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Do you know what happens if you don't have teeth?" So he says to the child, "It's very hard to eat crusty, hard bread because you can't chew it." So Rabbi Yisrael says, I want to ask you a favor. From now on, this bread that you're bringing me, this fresh bread that your mother is baking to send to me, I want you to deliver that, the soft bread, to the beggars in town, and bring me their hard 2-day-old bread instead. But don't tell anyone, because if you tell anyone, they won't let you do that anymore." On Yom Kippur, on Erev Yom Kippur, another Elzman story. So he walked past a Jew on the way to, you know, whatever it was, on the day before Yom Kippur. And so this Jew was feeling the weight of the Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment, and Yom Kippur. And he wore it on his face, the trembling and the fear, which was the culmination of 40 days at that point of working through Elzman. And Rabbi Yisrael said, gave him a greeting, and the Jew like ignored him. He was like so involved in his own fear and trepidation of Erev Yom Kippur that he just walked right past him. And so Rabbi Yisrael stopped him and said, "Rabbi Yin, the fact that you're preparing for the day of dread is not my problem. You still have an obligation to greet me with a smile when you pass me on the street, because your face is a reshus harabim. Your face is a public domain. So whatever you want going on inside, that's your business. Skegazente, do what you want. But you can't walk past me and not say hello just because you're in your own inner spiritual world. There was a certain, another one, one last story. I'll probably tell some more later, but one last story for now. There was a certain a square where they used to make weddings. So there were, as in, I guess every society, there were the weddings for those who had money and the weddings for those who didn't have money. So those who made their weddings, who had money, made it in a certain place. And there was a certain shoemaker who in general was in the class of Jews who did not have money, and he made it. He was doing well for himself. So he made a wedding for his daughter in the rich people's section. And the rich people in town didn't take to this, that the shoemaker was making a wedding in the area that was generally designated for the upper class. And so one of the members of this upper class, towards the end of the wedding, came over to the father of the bride and took off his shoe and held it up to the shoemaker's face and said, "How much would it cost to fix this shoe? How much is it?" In a degrading, humiliating way as he's making a wedding. And Yisrael said, at this moment, the leaders, the Rabbanim, are being judged up in heaven for not teaching their Balabatim how to act. Right now, as this is taking place, there's a din taking place, a harsh judgment up in heaven, and all the teachers of that Jew, they're getting it right now, that such a Jew could say such a thing and make another Jew feel less than under such a circumstance. This is the person, these are the types of stories that they tell about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter.
Did he tell it to him or did he tell it to him?
That I don't know. The way that I saw the story was he said about it. I mean, maybe he said it to him, I don't know. So how did he do it? What was his system? How is he going to revitalize the Jewish people and make us the types of people that were necessary? So the first thing that he did is he brought back the original Musar Svarim, the books that had been written, some of which we've discussed, which were sitting on shelves. He made it a thing, that this is what everybody needs to be studying. We need to be working through these works of Musar and making it part of our daily routine. And then he had a number of tools that he introduced to his students, his bodidus. His bodidus means seclusion, the idea of being by yourself, to be able to contemplate, to be able to disconnect from, this is before cell phones even, where we really need it, to be able to disconnect from all of the things in the world that are distractions and don't allow us to get in touch with ourselves, to understand what's driving us, what's going on inside of us, what do we need work on. One can't accomplish, one can't change, one can't improve if one's not aware or in touch of the things that are going on around him. So he had a concept, a method, a tool of his bodhidus to be by oneself for a specific amount of times or a specific amount of time a day to be able to accomplish that. He created what's called the Beis HaMusar, the Musar house, a specific place to come and work on Musar. This is a really brilliant, this is an innovation. Because, as anybody knows, you know, if you're trying to do something by yourself in an environment where nobody else is doing it, it's really hard. You know, take a classic example, take Shabbos or Kashrus. So if you want to keep Shabbos, and you live in an Orthodox community where all your friends are keeping Shabbos, it's a lot easier to keep Shabbos than if you're the only one doing it, and all your friends and colleagues are not. That is significantly more difficult when you're alone on an island as opposed to everybody else is doing it. So he created an environment where everybody who comes here is working on themselves. So instead of just being an individual alone on an island trying to improve and being invested in your character development, come here. That's what everybody's doing. In this place, this is what we do here. And when you create that environment, so then the growth in that place becomes all the more easy. In that environment, he created the Musar Shmooze. Now remember, now we're all familiar with that. That's just become a term. I got a shmooze from this one, I got a shmooze from that one. In the yeshivas, there's an official Musar Shmooze today. The Rabbanim of Eastern and Western Europe spoke how many times a year? Twice. Two times a year, the Rabbanim gave drashas. Shabbat Shuvah and Shabbat HaGadol. Before Pesach, before Yom Kippur. That's it. I've asked my board to go back to that weekly. Wouldn't that be nice, you know, to hear from me? The idea today is a derivation, not only this, there's some other things also, but there are four movements. There are many factors that led to where we are today. But in the 1800s, the Rav spoke twice a year. Rabbi Yisrael said, "Well, when are you going to get everybody Musar? When are you going to teach us how to be? When are you going to give us a shmooze to instruct us on appropriate behavior, on how to speak, on how to get rid of our anger, on how to develop patience, how to destroy our ego, how to not only run after kavod? When are we going to learn that?" So he developed the idea of a Musar shmooze. Which again, today, every shul in the world has a Rav which gets up. I don't know the numbers. I would make up 90% of shuls. The type of drasha that you get on a standard Shabbos morning is not a shir in halacha. but would be classified as some type of Musar Shmuz. Yes? I'm just making up a number, 90%. When you walk away from the Shmuz, the Drush on Shabbos morning, certainly I would say in North America, you've been instructed in some form of character behavior, right? I'm about myself for sure. You want to come to a shir? Come to a shir before davening, 20 minutes, we learn chumash. You want to come to a shir in halacha? Come Thursday night, we'll learn Gemara. Shabbos morning, you're going to hear something about improvement. That is Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. That is the idea of a Musar Shmuz, which transformed the Rav from giving two lectures, which were highly intellectual, pilpul shiurim twice a year, into an idea of a daily, if not weekly, injection of some type of Musar. Created the idea of the Pinkus. The Pinkus is the personal ledger, the idea of what we would call a cheshbon nefesh, or having a little notebook in which we would call it maybe a diary or a journal, in which every day a Jew, a Baal Musar, sits down and takes note. How did I do today? What did I do today? Correct. And he created that as a standard, where every day, 5 minutes before you go to sleep, how did I wake up this morning? How many times did I hit shmooze? How was my davening? Was I awake? Was I asleep? Did I pay attention? How did I interact with my spouse, with my kids, with my parents? What business? Did I have this job? Write down, because if you don't write down, you're not paying attention. If you're not paying attention, how are you going to improve? So write down, today I spoke Lashon Hara 10 times. Tomorrow it's going to be only 9. But you're not going to get from 10 to 9 if you don't write down that today I did 10. But if you write down that today I did 10, tomorrow you can write down I did 9. If you could say, I got angry, you yelled 3 times, and tomorrow I'll do 2. And so there was an idea of a ledger. And you would have it. And the ledger included a specific, for tefillah. That tefillah shouldn't be by rote. It shouldn't be just saying the words. You had to write every day what you were mechadesh, what novel idea or thought you had in davening today. Can you imagine? We just try to get through the words. He wanted the students, as you opened up the siddur to begin, what's going to be new? What new thought that when you should have at the end of a month a book of new thoughts, new approaches, new understandings to what it is that you're saying? What does this word mean? What is this phrase? What's its relevance to you today that was different than it was yesterday? The idea of his lahavus, of being with fervor, fulfilling mitzvahs with fervor, studying Musar with fervor, that you should take a line and say it over and over and over again till it becomes a part of you, till it becomes burning within you, till it flows through your blood, through your veins. To take an example, the Gemara says that Avram, when he was promised by Hashem that he will inherit the land, said, Bama Eda ki Erishena. How do I know that I will inherit the land? And the Gemara takes Avram Avinu to task and says that he sinned in asking that question of how will I know, that it was a lack of bitachon. So Rabbi Yisrael taught, and the Musar, the Bali Musar, that a Musar student would say over and over again, Bama Eda, how will I know? Bama Eda, how will I know? Where is my Bama Eda? Where in my life am I short on this idea of Bama Eda? How will I know? Where am I short in my emuna? And for 20 minutes, 30 minutes straight, just to say over that one liner from the Gemara, when Avram asked Bama Eda, he was lacking in his emuna, that he had to ask the question, and where is that in my life? Until that idea becomes a part of who you are. And with every line, whether or not talking about getting angry or having patience or yelling, just to work it through over and over by yourself in a group with a passion and with a fervor. The goals of all these tools were two. Number one, as I mentioned a moment ago, to fight the idea of mitzvos anashim milimuda. There's a phrase the Gemara uses where a person does mitzvos by rote. He just does them. He's not paying attention. He has no idea what he's doing. I've told the story before. It's one of my favorite stories. That's probably an apocryphal story, but it's a great story. Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, who gives shiur in Brooklyn, New York, tells a story that he once had a Jew come to him in the morning, and he had his tefillin shel yad on. He put on his tefillin shel yad, and he was holding his tefillin shel rosh in his hands. And he came over to Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, and he said, "Rabbi, I'm stuck. I can't remember if I'm putting my tefillin on or if I'm taking them off." Think about that for a moment. I can't remember if I'm about to start davening and I'm putting my tefillin on, or if I just finished davening and I'm taking them off. I'm so oblivious to my davening, it meant nothing to me. I say the words every morning that now I don't even know. Did I do it this morning? I don't even know. So leave aside what the halacha would be in such a case. But that is an example of doing mitzvahs by rote. I did it, I think. I can't remember because wasn't paying attention. I just do it. I just say the words. Say, all of these tools are to fight that. Don't allow your mitzvahs in your life to be by rote. Everything you do is thought out, is with purpose, with feeling, and with emotion. And that's to create. The second goal is to create Yirah Shamayim, to create a fear of heaven. To create an idea that everything that we do, every word that we say, every thought that we have is recorded, is judged, matters. And a Jew has to live with those two principles. I'm not living by rote, because everything that I do matters. And Rabbi Saul said, if a Jew lives with these things, we will indeed create a Jew that will counteract every claim against us from the maskilim that says that we're backwards, that we're irrelevant, that we're archaic, that we're not a person, a group of people that people want to be, to want to emulate. We should be. We want to be, but something happened on the way to the market. And this study, these tools, the shmuz, the Musar Seder, the idea of studying Musar, making tefillah relevant, paying attention to someone else's gashmias, their physical needs is my spiritual growth, to be kind and to be sensitive and to smile. All of these things is going to be the challenge to modernity, which was the driving issue in the 1800s as the world shifted out of the Middle Ages into the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. Where was the Jew going to fit in this new world? Said Rabbi Yisrael, we're going to be front and center. Just have to pay attention to what we're doing to get there. And this is how we're going to do it, through these tools and through this movement. Was he successful? So the answer is yes and no. Good Jewish answer. A good Jewish answer. You know what? Let's do a couple of his other. Let's go through some of his saying and teaching. I have a few minutes left. Let's just go. These are so good. On the top of page 3. One's character traits are his only true possessions. You want to know who you are and what you have? Now again, he didn't make this up. I could show you a source for the Maral and a Rashi in Parshas Noach that says this exact same thing. Eile told us Noach ish tzaddik. Who? What is Noach? Same thing. But he made this into a mantra that this is what needs to be taught. Your only true possessions are your character traits. It's the only thing we take with us after 120 years. Said Rabbi Yisrael, this was one of his most famous lines, it is more difficult to fix one negative character trait than it is to review all of the Talmud. Now, for those of you not familiar, how hard is it to review all of the Talmud? 2,711 pages. Not so simple. Even if you did a page a day, Daf Yomi, it's going to take you 7.5 years. And how well will you know it if you only did one page a day? And said Rabbi Yisrael, it's harder to fix one negative character trait than to review all of the Talmud. There is no needier person than the one who is dependent on kavod. Oh, what a beautiful phrase. This one has needs, this one needs money, this one needs... You know, the neediest person is the one who's dependent on other people's kavod, giving them kavod. That is the neediest person's. Person's ability to see into the distance can be obstructed by a single coin. Oh, gorgeous, right? You know, one little coin in front of you and the quest for money can obstruct your entire view of long-term planning, long-term goals, what's going on in the world. One coin in front of you, both in a physical and will obstruct every ability for you to see beyond that. Don't recommend bitachon when it comes to another person's needs. Someone has needs. You help them. You don't tell them to have faith. You want to tell yourself to have faith. I don't need money. I don't need a job. You want to, okay. You can be talking all you want. Don't dare say that to someone else. Someone else has a problem. You help fix their problem. Don't tell them to have bitachon. Another one of his very famous ones is when you're wrapping yourself with your towels in the morning, make sure you don't smack somebody else in the face with the strings in your religious fervor to wrap yourself. Make sure you're looking behind you, that you're not hitting somebody else while you wrap yourself in your talus. It's worth a lifetime of Musar study to refrain from a single word of Lashon Hara. If one word you hold yourself back, an entire lifetime of Musar study was worth it for that one word that you were able to refrain. When he was told that a shochet had become disqualified because people in his town were suspicious that there were flaws in his slaughtering knife. The knife of a shochet has got a lot of difficult checks to make sure that there are no nicks or bruises or dents in the knife, which would disqualify it. So he was told that a certain shochet was removed from his post, that the people suspected that he had flaws in his knife. His comment on that is, who knows how many flaws were in the knife used to slaughter the shochet. When they removed him, how many flaws were in those people who claimed on him that his ritual observance isn't correct? You see a common theme in his teachings, in his sayings, and what he was trying to accomplish amongst the Jewish people. So his legacy, was he successful or not successful? So as we started, well, yes and no. The no is, as a mass movement, which was his objective and his goal, he did not succeed. The Muslim movement did not take on its mass movement. It was not for the masses. The masses didn't have the time or the patience or the strength, and all that was going on, as we started with, in the 1800s in Eastern Europe, didn't work. But what did happen is that it took hold in the yeshiva world. There it did, very much take hold. And through that, almost everything that I said tonight probably isn't new to you because it's become part of our world. These ideas are all standard practice in our world. The idea of learning Musar, the idea of a Musar shmooze, the idea of paying attention to these things, of not whacking somebody with your tzitzis when you're putting on your talus to make sure that he doesn't get it. All of those ideas through the yeshivas where it took hold, then came about. And I want to just show you exactly a little bit how that happened. He birthed an entire yeshiva movement. I remember he's a student of Reb Chaim Volozhin. He's a student of a student. Reb Chaim Volozhin had the student of Reb Zundel of Salant. Reb Zundel of Salant was the Rebbe of Reb Yisrael of Salanter. Reb Chaim of Volozhin, two generations back, opened up the first of the modern day yeshivas of the yeshiva in Volozhin. From Rabbi Yisrael Salanter became an entire genre of yeshiva, of the Musar yeshiva. Now that the yeshiva movement had begun, he birthed, through his process, an idea of the Musar yeshiva. Kelm, Nevarduk, Slobodka, these famous yeshivas were all Musar yeshivas, which focused heavily not just on learning of Gemara, but on Musar as a primary part of their day and of their structure. Now, the Vardak and Slobodka were two different types of yeshiva. The Musar movement took two different, very, very different approaches. One was the greatness of mankind, and one was the smallness of mankind. And there are two, they're both true. Whether or not you look at man like through a microscope or through use a telescope. In other words, you see man as amazing. Man is just almost like an angel. He can create, he can do. The potential to change the world is enormous. That was the yeshiva of Slobodka. It's limitless what man can accomplish. And you need to walk around with that sense. You need to be dressed appropriately because you are godly. And your shoes have to be shined and polished. And your language has to always be intelligent and respectful. And you have to be educated because you are royalty. And Nirvaduk took the other approach, that man, who is man? Man is but nothing, tola, verima, like worms, you're nothing. In Nirvaduk, they would send the boys out to the hardware store to buy a cupcake, just so that they should be laughed at and embarrassed to realize it doesn't matter what people think. The world, this world is an olam hazeh, and it's meaningless. The only thing that matters is your character development, and they would specifically, constantly be working on having nothing and needing nothing. In Slobodka, it was how great they were. In the Vardik, they used to joke. The joke in the yeshivas, I remember hearing this many, many times, which was all about the lowliness of man and that you're nothing, that a new boy showed up in the Vardik. And he sees during Musa Seder, all the boys are walking up and down the aisle saying, Ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish. I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing. So the new boy walks into the yeshiva and he sees the whole Musa Seder. Everybody's just walking up and down saying, Ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish. I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. So he says, oh, okay, I guess that's what you do here. So he starts walking up and down. Ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish. Someone says to him, who are you to be a nothing? You just got here. You can't be a nothing yet. Like, you need to work on that. You just become a nothing just like that. So they say in the yeshiva, I forget which yeshiva, they say there was somebody left a wallet or money, a dollar somewhere on a windowsill. He was visiting the yeshiva, and he came back 3 years later, and it was still there. But it had been dusted, and they picked it up, they cleaned, but nobody in this yeshiva, like, no one's going to touch it, and whoever's going to come out, it was still there 3 years, exactly where it was taken care of. You know, that was the yeshivas. From Reb Yisrael, on these yeshivas, his first generation students include Reb Yitzchak Blazer, who wrote the Or Yisrael, as he mentioned, with Mtali Amsterdam, Reb Eliezer Gordon, who founded the Telzi Yeshiva, Reb Yaakov Yosef, RJJ Yeshiva in New York. Second generation students included Reb Nassim Tzvi Finkel of Slobodka, and from him came, you'll recognize some of these names, Rabbi Yerucham Levovitz of Vemir, Rabbi Aaron Kotler of Lakewood, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky of Torah Vidas, Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Rudiman of Ner Yisrael, Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner of Chaim Berlin, Rabbi David Leibovitz of Chofetz Chaim. All of those Rashi yeshiva who founded these yeshivas, so if you talk about the American yeshivas, Chofetz Chaim Berlin, Torah Vidas, Ner Yisrael, Lakewood, Mir, all of them are directly traced to the Musar yeshivas of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's students. So was he successful in the movement that he wanted to create in the 1800s? No. It did not take off as a mass movement. Was he successful in completely revolutionizing the Jewish world? 100%. Because there is not a Rav, this may be a little grandiose statement, but I think it's probably true. There's not a Rav today, Rebbe, who is not influenced by someone on this list. In today's modern day, who didn't have himself, like someone like me who didn't either learn in one of these yeshivas, didn't have a Rebbe who learned in one of these yeshivas, where there's not a yeshiva today that doesn't have a Musar Seder, that doesn't have the concept of a Musar Shmuz, that doesn't have the concept of a Cheshbon HaNefesh, that's standard practice in a growth-oriented yeshiva student. These are things, it's become the practice that everyone in a shul gets a rav who's going to give him a 15-minute drusha on Shabbos, that most Shabbosim will not be based on halacha, but will in some way be about ethical, moral, character development, is all a tribute to Reb Yisrael Salanter. All the stories that we tell. I mean, these are Rosh Hashanah. I just saw like 8 Rosh Hashanah drushas just in this last hour. All of the stories about him are, that's what it's about. These are the stories that we tell, and that is his legacy. It's 9 o'clock. Let me. There's one. I have to mention there were detractors. There were those who were opposed to Rebbe. During his lifetime, you couldn't really. He was so above it, but there were those who were opposed to this method of study, spending so much time on the study of Musar, as opposed to there were those who held. You learn Bava Kama, learn that you'll get your Musar, and everything is in the Gemara. You don't need a special study. You don't need to be focused on that. But there were other claims. But as I mentioned, overall, the yeshivas that his students founded are the yeshivas today, from which Torah emanates, and now it's sort of the next generation. And there are many other types of yeshivas. Now, of course, in Israel, there's an entire new genre of yeshiva. But his legacy will remain. One, I don't know if it's a sad one poignant story with which I'll conclude, which I think will tell us a little bit about the era that he was in. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had a son, a mathematician, a genius, who became a maskil, which is not uncommon in Jewish history, that great Jewish leaders who were fighting a certain battle had from within their own home the same struggles. Not uncommon at all. So he had such a son who was a genius. I believe there's something called the Lippmann parallelogram, which is a certain math formula, which is well known. That's his son. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's son was a Lippmann, and he was offered a position in the St. Petersburg University, and the requirement to convert was waived. Generally, a Jew was not allowed to take a position in St. Petersburg University unless he converted to Christianity. He was such a genius that they waived that, and they allowed him to be a professor. The Maskilim at the time saw this as the greatest triumph. And they took out a full-page ad in the Jewish newspapers congratulating the Gadol Hador, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, on the appointment of his son to this position of a math position in the esteemed St. Petersburg Yeshiva University, and how this accomplishment of being able to teach in the secular world is l'shem u'l'tiferes, is for the glory of the Jewish people and the fulfillment of all that we strive for. And congratulations to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter on not stopping his son from the fulfillment of Jewish idealism. Just again to give you a picture of what it was like between the Maskilim and the Jews at the... at the time. Rabbi Yisrael took out an ad, a full-page ad, in the next month's edition. And he wrote that my entire life has been about the fulfillment of truth, and that quest forces me to respond to last month's article praising this accomplishment of my son. And he wrote, the truth is, I have no nachas from my son. And if anyone has the ability to speak to him and convince him of the error of his ways and return him to the path of his father, I would be most appreciative and bless him in this world and the world to come. But this is not l'shem u'l'tiferes of the Jewish people, and I am forced to respond in such a manner. And again, it's so hard for us to imagine the reality of life in that stage, but I think it's important to acknowledge the reality of that the Maskilim would take out such an article to Rabbi Yisrael, and that he would be forced to take an article, an ad out saying, this is not a nachas for me, and I'm not proud of it, and my entire life is dedicated against this, and if anyone can convince my son to return home, you know, I'd be forever indebted to him. So, it was a sign of the times, of the battles that were being waged. It's a complicated time, and it's not. You can't just like sugarcoat it and say that it was all fun and games. It was not. And these three movements, which we're now still in the middle, we've done the Hasidim, Hasidus, and we did now the Musar movement. And Mirtz Hashem, the next class we have, either the next month or two, will be Rabbi Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, which was in Western Europe, which was a battle against Reform Judaism and the idea of what we would call today modern Orthodox, which was combining the two, which was a third or fourth prong attempt to deal with modernity, which was, of course, the issue of the time. And we'll see about how Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch tried to address this threat of modernity. But next week, again, next week is no class because the Mayor of State is here. I think the following, if I remember correctly, is a special Purim class. And then we'll continue after that with the rest of our program. So wish you all a wonderful night. And we will have the Nash for the sponsorship, Meretz Hashem, next week. And look forward to in 2 weeks. Now we'll see you all then. Have a great night.